All right, we bring in the third base coach of the San Francisco Giants, Ron Wotus. Well, how are you?
Good evening, Marty. I'm doing great, and it is nice to see all the details come down with the possible reopening for Major League Baseball. I think that gives us all a little bit of hope and something to look forward to. So we'll see how it plays out and how they iron out all these particular details and negotiations. And as you said, the train has left the station.
Yeah, it's going to happen. It's just a question of how we do it. No one's going to take a position in stone here, say, I'm sorry, we're not doing this, and we'll see in 2021. It's just that's not in the cards for this country or for baseball. So, as I said on the show, a lot of negotiations and things that affect you as a third base coach. Get your mask ready, I'll tell you that, and I don't mean a catcher's mask. You're going to need the Lone Ranger mask. Because when Posey gets to third base, you're going to have to talk them through a mask, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I could use a catcher's mask and shin guard down there sometimes when those big right-handed hitters up and you have the soft toss and lefty throwing that slow breaking ball and that cutter inside. We'll see how it pans out. You know, I'm not through all the little details and everything. And again, I think, things will be ironed out. They'll be negotiated, as you said, a mask possibly at third base, possibly staying away from my face, giving signs. But it's on paper at this point in time, and we have weeks left before the final decisions come in. Whatever it is, I think we're all hopeful that we can get back to baseball, and that would be a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. Well said. I didn't think about that. Well, about touching your face on signs. Wow, I had not thought about that. So it's going to be bunt is a belt, and let's see, shirt is a steal. I guess that's it, huh?
Marty, what am I going to use now? You just told all these listeners with the blowtorch going all over the country and into Europe. I don't know what I'm going to do now.
Very good. Hey, before Bill joins us in just a second, I was thinking about River Islands today. And, of course, I've got a lot of time, and we all do, to think about a lot of things. And with everybody working from home and the new normal, and this is going to last for a while, and even when this is all settled, I think people are going to realize they can work from home. And the commute is going to be different. And we talk a lot about, River Islands being an hour from this place or that place in the commute. But when you think about it, the homes are so affordable. And the area is so beautiful, and there's so much to do there. And now you can actually work from home, and you don't have to commute. I think River Islands all of a sudden looks a little different to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. Very attractive. It was attractive before this point that you're bringing up. But I think a lot of people are going to work from home, and it's not only going to benefit them, but it's going to benefit, some traffic in the Bay Area. We all deal with the traffic in the Bay Area. I live in the East Bay, and with less cars on the road, that's one positive of this whole thing. And as you just said so well, River Islands has so much out there that we've talked about, the soccer fields and the restaurant and the baseball stadium they have, the walking trails, kayaking, you name it. And hopefully, Marty, I'm looking forward to a little bocce ball, you and I, when this thing gets over, so we can see who is the true bocce champion.
I like it. I can do this, I think. I think we Miami Beach, when we grew up in one of the parks in South Beach, before South Beach was South Beach, we used to have a bocce ball court. All right. I accept the challenge. We'll do that.
All right. Good.
All right. Hey, joining us is Bill Lasky. Bill, how are you tonight?
Hey, I want in on this bocce ball now. Come on now. You got to let me in this game. I mean, come on. I used to be a pitcher now. I know those walls pretty well and the speed of the bocce ball, too. Come on, Woe. I'm after you now.
All right, Bill. You're in, too. I didn't want to take you on because you kind of threw almost underhand like you throw the bocce hand. I mean, that arm got lower and lower later in your career. That's why you had such good sinks. So it will be a challenge, but I'm up for it.
All right, gentlemen. Good way to start. A nice challenge.
Yeah. All right. It always leads me to something here, and that is, a bocce ball is heavy, if I'm correct, if I remember it. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about Roger Munter. Remember Roger Munter, guys? Remember him?
The pitcher for us?
Yeah.
Remember we him? Right-handed pitcher with the bowling ball sinker. Yes.
Exactly. How about that? What did this guy throw? But whatever it was just you couldn't hit it.
No, he did. He had a heavy ball, just like Brandon Webb with Arizona. Certain guys with their arm angle and their release point. And, you know, Trevor Cahill, who's with us, has an outstanding sinker. I mean, he always had one. But I think of Brandon Webb. I think of Munter. He had a sinker in that category. And there's only one other guy maybe that is in that category, and we're speaking to him tonight. So we'll throw Lasky in there, too, along with the bone chip. And this tough pitch to hit.
Well, I tell you, the whole key to a sinker is release. We all know it. And then it's a two-seamer, so your two fingers are really placed on the seams, and you're putting pressure on your index finger more than your middle finger. But the guys that used to throw some of the nasty sinkers, I mean, you had a lot of guys where the ball just fell right off the plate. And you're talking about Munter and some of these other dudes, Ron, and that's exactly what it was. When Ron calls it a hard sinker, it's that last break. It's that that topple of the pitch where it falls off the plate. And when a pitcher's throwing that, you can aim for ankles, you can aim for shins, and that ball will tail right to it. So, I mean, that's an arsenal pitch. Everybody usually threw them back in our day, but a lot of pitchers have gone away from it because they like to see that radar gun hitting 100 with those cross seamers.
Mm. Boy, you know who comes to mind for me, Woe and Bill? Two pitchers. One, Derek Lowe. And the other one is Jason Marquis. Remember both of them? Weren't they sinkers all the way?
Yes, they were. They were. Lowe had that bowling ball type sinker like Brandon Webb. He had a lot more depth on his sinker. I think Jason Marquis had a little more late life and late sink. It didn't sink quite as much for me, and I think that's the difference with some of these sinker ballers. You know, you mentioned Munter. Munter, it seemed like he had a 2-foot drop on that thing, almost like it was a changeup. So some guys had that big sink and some guys just had that little late sink, which also kept the ball off the barrel of the bat.
Well, you know, the best one was Greg Maddux. He could make that ball dance right off the outside corner. And we always talk about Glavine and Maddux using the corner and what the umpire is going to give them on the black or a little off the black. And they'll keep going farther and farther out until that umpire finally calls it a ball and they know how far they can catch that edge. That's what was great about movement of that pitch, just like a slider, but a sinker's down and into a righty or away to a left-hander. And the only way a hitter is going to do that is if they stay back and push it out to left field. And that's what good left-hand hitters did.
Boy, well, I'm going to ask you this one. Of Smoltz, Glavine, and Maddux, who is the toughest?
Whew.
Oh, geez, Bill. I mean, they were all tough. I think it depends what type of hitter that you were. And I think that, you know, there were three different pitchers, really. I mean, you know, Smoltz had the power, and boy, he had electric stuff. You know, he can blow the ball by you, but he also could pitch. He probably had the best stuff of the bunch. If I was a scout, I probably would have taken him on my club. And Glavine, he just, as Bill said, he worked the corners. He had that great changeup, kept you off balance, and he could pull the string with the best of them, never threw the ball over the middle. And then Maddux is kind of like Glavine or a little closer to Smoltz. I mean, he didn't have overpowering stuff, but similar to Glavine on the corners. I mean, you know, did Maddux look like he ended up statistically? Did he have the best career of the three, or was it John Smoltz? Because I'd pick one of those two guys. Bill could stick his neck out here and tell us who the best guy is or who he would take.
Well, you know, I think, Ron, you hit it right on the head. If you wanted velocity with a hard curveball or slider, Smoltz was the guy, and he delivered. And then look at how many years he was the closer there, too. So, I mean, his dominance made him into a Hall of Famer. You look at Glavine and Maddux, I think they're very similar, righty and left-hander. And you put all three of them together, put Smoltz in the middle. That was a dominating Braves rotation back there. And Leo Mazzone, my buddy, was a pitching coach who you couldn't have had a better guy in your corner as a pitching coach. He was a fierce competitor, and he brought that out of all three of them.
Well, you know,
I was just going to add that, you know, Bill mentioned it earlier, And, you know, back in the day when they didn't have this Quest Tech and you had Joe West and guys out there on getaway day and you had a Glavin or a Maddox on the mound, they'd be calling strikes 6 inches outside. That's when the catcher could set up in the other batter's box and it was called a strike. So it was a different time. And I know Bill had those umpires that he liked, and you can get away with murder.
Well, that's a good thing, though.
All right. What about Eddie Montague? Where does Eddie fall into this?
Oh, he fell right in there. He pinched a corner for you. Big Lee Wire was that Big Lee Wire. He put you on a corner. Lee would call it a half an inch off the corner, inch off the corner, and you get him on a good day, and you get a whole ball off the corner. But Ron's exactly right. In our era, that's how umpires did. And you also, in our area, had the National League umpires, and they had the American League umpires. So you were with the umpire crews a lot during the season. And you knew guys that could play with the strike zone, open it up a little bit. And then you had guys like Bruce Fromming said, nope, that's a ball. Shut up. You're a rookie. Carry on.
Did you ever get into a Fromming woe?
You know, actually, I did, believe it or not. It was my rookie year. It was my rookie year in San Francisco in 1998. And I came to the park. We had a game the day before, a few months into the season. And I came to the park, and Brandon Evans, one of our clubhouse guys, said, hey, Bruce Fromming wants to talk to you in the umpire's room. And this was after BP. Well, the game before, I guess a couple games before, you know, I was a little excitable back in the day. And, you know, umpires would make bad call, and I'd throw my hands up in the air, or I'd chirp at them. And Bruce Fromming, being, you know, the veteran umpire, I guess he wanted to teach me a lesson. And anyway, so I'm going to Brandon Evans. He wants to talk to me? Why? So I go to the umpire's room, and he's in there with the rest of his crew, and he sits me down, and he proceeds to tell me about my conduct as a bench coach. And right away, I didn't want to have any of this because I felt like, he was putting me on the spot here. And you know how the way us guys are. You know, my chest bowed up, and I told them if they make the right calls on the field, you wouldn't hear anything from the dugout, and I walked out. So anyways, you know, time goes by, and we became pretty good friends after that and had a lot of good conversations after that. But he was one of the main umpires back in the day, and, you know, he tried to teach not just the umpires how to do it, but he wanted to tell some of the coaches how to go about it. So he was a nice guy.
Boy, you know, it's funny. We talk about umpires, and it made me think of a story, you know, that happened in the late 40s with Dario Lodigiani, who is a well-known icon of baseball in Northern California, played in the 40s for the Philadelphia A's, and was one of the 9 old men of the Oakland Oaks in the late 40s, but always came to the ballpark, Dario Lodigiani. And he told me there was an umpire in the late 40s who had a whole bench of Ron Wotuses chirping at him the whole game. And he cleared the whole bench. He put them all in the clubhouse and told Jimmy Dykes, the manager, said that if you need anybody, you can bring them back one by one. And I said, you know, that was pretty cool. And I said to ask you guys, I was thinking to ask you guys, you ever have an incident with an umpire where they cleared everybody but didn't actually throw them out and just got rid of them?
I can't see that. I had a lot of warnings, you know, where the umpire would come over and warn the bench or warn certain people. I always was surprised how they could pick out one guy. You'd have 6-10 guys on the rail, and they would pick the certain guy out, and you're gone. And I'd be like, who's hooking and looking at these guys? Because you'd always have a couple guys popping off. And, of course, one guy pops off, 10 guys pop off. That's how our bench always was, and that's how baseball is. I like Ron when he was saying when he put his arms up, he did that a lot. You did that a lot in your career. you were battling umpires all the time on a bad call.
Well, I came up as a manager. I managed, you know, 7 years in the minor leagues. I felt that's, you know, that's what I was there to do. And it was a different time. And, you know, I felt like the umpires needed to know if they missed a call. And, you know, you don't take it too far. But to your question, Marty, I've had many umpires, you know, threaten to run the whole group. You know, everybody, I'll run you all out of there. I've heard that, you know, more than a handful of times. And the one time that comes to mind, we may have talked about this, so I'll keep it brief, but we were in Midland, Texas when I was managing the Shreveport Captains. And guys were chirping, and the umpire looks in our dugout, and he throws out Jose Alguacil. He was on the team as our first base coach, and he didn't speak any English at the time. And, you know, so I went out to argue with the umpire. I says, he didn't say anything because, you know, a bunch of guys were chirping. I said, this guy doesn't even speak English. So I ended up getting thrown out, and I really felt bad for Augie because of all the people in the dugout. Like Bill said, the umpires really don't know who's talking, but you can't throw out a Latin when it's an American guy yelling at you in English.
I love Augie. Boy,
that's a good one.
So that's what happened with Dario. So I guess when they needed a player, they'd go in the clubhouse and bring him back. And so that was that. I'd have to ask Eddie Montague if he ever threatened to run the whole team. We'll see.
He did. There's no doubt about it. Eddie had a little redneck on him when you got him going. No doubt.
Oh yeah. Yeah, Eddie wouldn't take anything. I bet you he's thrown out multiple guys from the dugout before. That'd be my bet.
Okay, all right. Well, he may be listening. Eddie, if you're listening, he always says he's got a lemonade in the backyard, and he listens to the show. So we'll see if he's listening tonight.
Hey Ron, he always threw you out with your left hand, though. You know, Ed Monty, you always had that lefty in him.
I love it. Hey, we had a couple of things. One, I got to watch a Don Larsen perfect game from the 1956 World Series. And, you know, it's an amazing game and a couple of great catches. Mickey Mantle makes a great catch in left center field on a ball that Gil Hodges drilled. And Jackie Robinson hit one off the third baseman that went right to the shortstop, and they threw him out. If you talk about luck in a perfect game. But in the eighth inning, Sal Magley, who's pitching for the Dodgers, is in trouble. And the Yankees are threatening to bust it open. It's 2-0. So Walter Alston comes out to the mound to talk to Magley. And I love watching these old games because the games were different. You kind of did what you wanted to do. Everyone kind of just hung around. So Alston's on the mound. He talks to Magley and gives him advice and then leaves. And he's about five, six, seven steps off the mound. And Jackie Robinson says something. And all of a sudden, Alston comes back on the mound and talks to Gilliam and talks to Robinson and Campanella and all this. And then he leaves and Magley finishes the inning, and it's an interesting double play to end it, which we'll talk about later. But it made me think, of the Don Mattingly incident where you guys nailed him for, making two trips to the mound when he stepped off the mound and went back on. How about that?
Yeah, no, that was the same scenario. He came out, spoke to the pitcher. He left the dirt. And of course, you can't leave the dirt and come back. It's a second trip. And he did so, and Boach was all over it. You know, I saw it registered with me after Boach, and Boach was already out his way of the dugout. And I said, there we go, we got him. And sure enough, two trips, he had to take the pitcher out of the game. So, yeah, you know, as a manager, you know, working in the minor leagues for the 7 years, those were some of the things that you never wanted to mess up, right? I mean, if you're in this game long enough where you're able to cut your teeth and your craft in the minor leagues, you know, hopefully these mistakes are made when you're in the minor leagues and you never forget them, right? The best way to learn something is if you make a mistake and be darn sure that you never let that happen again. And it happened, and it happened, and Boach was all over it. Same scenario.
Hey, Ron, in spring training, when all your coaches and managers, and I'm talking minor leagues, I'm not talking big leagues, do you guys go into a room and talk about different things like that as a manager and some of the different rules that maybe AAA, AA, single A managers, I mean, you're a veteran manager, you might be able to lend a couple words of saying these are the things you should keep looking on? Because rules change, there's no doubt in baseball. Is there something in an educational part that the minor leaguers do for all their coaches and managers?
You know, they may do something now. Back when I was coming up, there was nothing. You kind of learned on your own, and you spoke to the other coach or coaches. Usually we had a pitching coach and one other coach with the club. And you pretty much learned your own way, and you did it by managing a lot of games and just playing year after year and talking to different people you're around. Now, they may train them in the minor leagues. They may have more, seminars that these managers can go to. One thing that I'm a fan of, we never had them come to spring training. but there's guys that come in and explain all the rules. You can have a rules guy come into the spring training, and, you know, he can talk about these funky base running plays and stuff like that, because the players need to hear it. You know, the inflatable fly rule, the pop-up, so players understand, because there's some rules in there. When you're out on the field, I'm sure a lot of these players don't know. And so they may do some training like that, but they didn't when I was coming up.
Boy, you know, it makes me, you know, it's so much fun to talk baseball with you guys. Talking about this World Series game, well, and this is a good baseball moment for the professor. And, Bill, this would be a good one for you, too, being a pitcher. So it's the eighth inning, and it's first and third, and Yogi Berra is up, and Magley gets him to hit a shot to Gil Hodges. It's one out, and Hodges steps on the bag and then comes home. And Campanella catches it, and the runner coming down the line now is in a rundown. And Campy throws it early and throws it in the dirt. And Jackie Robinson, a third, dives for it in the dirt from his knees, throws back to the plate, and they get the runner for the double play. And I said to myself, boy, when you go to the bag, you take some time. And you could mess that play up at the plate. And I thought maybe they should come. The run was so important, you should come right home. Well, what's the baseball way to approach that?
Well, there is. In that scenario, first and third and one out, I mean, you have a lot of options, right? I mean, you can come right home with the ball because that's a big run, but now you're probably not going to turn two. So if you are an instinctive fielder and you've gone over to the scenarios and you know your runners and you're that close to the bag, I don't have a problem stepping on the bag. And if you do step on the bag, I think the fielder made the right decision going home, because if you step on the bag and you go to second, if you don't execute that rundown before that run scores, they're going to score. So he took the one out. He knew he had the guy hung up at home. Even though I don't like having a rundown between home, because typically your catchers, you know, they can never catch the runner, right? So the rundown takes a little bit longer. But once you step on the bag, it's hard not to step on the bag if you're that close. So I don't fault the fielder for doing that. But the other thing you can do if you have a slow batter runner, as soon as you catch that ball, you can throw to second, come back to first, double play with no rundown. So those are your two options, really, is to throw to second, come to first for no throw, no rundown, or step on the bag and go home because you have him up. You don't really want to go to second base because now you're risking that guy scoring if the rundown takes more than a couple throws.
Bill?
I just think quick reaction right there, and we talked about a few weeks ago when Ron was talking about JT Snow catching that ball down the line, tagging first and going to second. This is similar, I do believe. I just think it's really instinct of the first baseman of doing what he needed to do. But, you know, you're absolutely right. How many throws, you said, Marty, three or four throws?
Yeah, it's too many.
To get the guy home?
Yeah,
that's the first thing I thought of, too. And I know Ron, being a professor, I mean, you don't want more than two throws, and you want to decrease the ability to get that runner as soon as you can. So interesting, but, you know, I did watch a couple of those innings. It was fun to watch, Marty, with the black and white, and it really brought back a lot of old memories when I was a little boy watching those games.
Yeah, you know, well, because Campy, you know, he was one of the best catchers in the history of baseball. And I said, keep running him and then throw it when you close the gap. I just think you just watch these rundowns so many times. And I don't get it. I know you guys work on it in spring training. You got another spring training coming up. And it's that first throw, you should nail him on the first throw.
Well, that's the problem, Marty. It's one play. We could work on it till we're blue in the face, and it really boils down to your players. And instinctively, what happens is guys have a tendency, they don't want to screw up, and they get rid of the ball too quick. You really need to get the runner running hard where he can't change direction. But you see it. I would say half your players, it's a judgment play is really what it is, and they don't want to be late because then the guy runs by you. So being cautious and making sure they're not throwing, you know, messing up, they throw it too early. Now the runner never got running full speed. He can change direction, and that's why you have the fire drill going with the guy going back and forth. But if you get that guy running as hard as you can, get him to turn his back, and then the receiving player cuts down the distance, gets a little momentum, and it's judged perfectly with the thrower, it's going to take one throw. But that's one of those plays that I'm telling you, every year we see the circus on that play, and we just hope that we get the guys out.
Yeah, boy, amazing. I'll give you another one. The crazy plays. We had fun with that Ruben Rivera one a couple of weeks ago. But Jason Stark, and I don't know if you guys read The Athletic, but he wrote about Gene Segura. Did you read about this one? Gene Segura is playing for the Brewers, right? So he's on first. He steals second. All right. And now Ryan Braun is at the plate, and Ryan Braun walks. Well, and now it's first and second. And the next pitch, Segura takes off for third, and the pitcher steps off and gets him hung up. He can't get to third. Mm-hmm. Now he runs him back to second. But in the meantime, Braun has gone from first to second. So now both runners are at second base, and the shortstop tags both of them on the bag. And, of course, Braun is out because it's Segura's bag. Well, Segura thinks he's out. So Braun stays there, and now Segura goes to first base. And he Org is the coach. I think it was Dane Org is the coach. Says, stay here. And he stays there at first base, and then Braun is out. So in baseball history, Segura has now restolen first base. So to make it as crazy as it could possibly be, on the next pitch, he takes off for second to steal second again, and they throw him out. And that's the end of the inning. How about that?
Yeah.
What would you say to Segura on that, Robo?
Oh, shoot. I would look for the base running coach and tell him to go talk to him. I'd stay away from that one.
You see a lot of times when two runners get caught at one bag, similar to that, the coach is saying, stay there, stay there. And one of them guys, me or him, and then they just bolt automatically. But, I think the base running coach needs a little lesson on that one.
As a defensive coach, I've always told the infielders, to tag both guys. And hopefully the guy that has the bag steps off and re-tag him. Now you got yourself a double play.
Right.
If he leads the base, so you want to entice them into, because again, going back to the rules, some of these guys don't know that they're entitled to the base. They figured I'm tagged, and sometimes guys step off. You think you're on the base, you would just stay there, but I've seen it a number of times. Guys will step off the base.
So to make the play even crazier, I think it's Dane Org. I think he was the coach, the first base coach. I think if I have the right Org brother, he was the coach, so he puts his hands on Segura because Segura is ready to go into the dugout, and he pushes him back to first base, and the umpires missed that. How about that, Will?
You can't aid that guy. If you help him in any way, I tell you, I've almost been run over a couple times with wide turns at third, and I actually put my arms up one to brace the hit. But if you touch that guy and you stop him like that, he's going to be called out. So you can't do that.
What happens if they run into you? Is that an out, or does it have to be intentional?
Well, I think I end up on the DL. But besides that, I'm not quite sure. I don't think they will call it. They could. That's a good question. I'm not sure. I haven't seen it completely. If he runs into you and then stops and goes back to the base, they may call him out. I'm pretty sure they'll call him out for you aiding and stopping him. Even though he ran into you, I think he's going to be called out.
Mm. Boy, interesting. All right, we need Eddie Montague tonight.
We'll have to ask Eddie on that. Yeah. Where's Eddie at?
Yeah, where are you, Eddie? He's always telling me he's listening to the show. All right, a couple of things before we take our break. One, anniversaries. I love this day in baseball history. So much went on, but first home run in the long career of Darryl Strawberry today, 1983, and he hit it off a Pirate, Lee Tunnell. And, Lee Tunnell, and I think, Bill, you do too, and it turned out to be a pitching coach, right?
Yeah, Lee Tunnell and I came up with the Pirates around the same time. Matter of fact, one spring training, we lived together down at Bradenton Beach. Our wives are good friends, and of course, he went on to coach. He was with Milwaukee a couple of years ago. He was a bullpen coach with them, and then last year he moved over to Cincinnati with David Bell and has 1 year there under his belt. So, yeah, Lee, I've known him for a long, long time, back the early 80s when we came up with the Pirates. Nice guy. We played in AAA and played in the major leagues together.
Yeah, same here. I knew Lee. Had a lot of battles with him when we played the Pirates. He was in a rotation in early 80s, like you said, and I remember battling in him. And he was a mainstay in that rotation for a few years. It did very well.
Boy, you know,
yeah, he had
know
a little sink, huh? He had some sink on the ball too, didn't he?
I didn't want to bring up the sinker again. You know, I don't want to have a sinker show.
Well, what did Greg Minton throw? Didn't he throw it? He remember he had like 200 innings without giving up a home run. He had to have a sinker, right?
He had a right over the top, Marty, and I mean that thing dropped like a 12-6 curveball sometimes, and. He says, sometimes I threw it and hoped and prayed it sank, and most of the time it did. But when he was on, that ball was just dropping right off the table.
One of the great nicknames of all time, right? Moon Man?
Yeah, it was stuck. It was totally a name directed to him.
You know, another one I saw this week that jumped out at me, and Joe Girardi, and I like Joe Girardi. I really do. I liked him. As a player, as a manager, as a commentator, and he got on, virtual internet, what everyone does, and he taught a math class to young people, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, and used baseball as, you know, the vehicle for OPS and batting average and how to figure it out and dividing things, you know, the old ways without a computer. And I thought, boy, you know, it's nice because I knew as a kid growing up, you know, I had baseball cards, and the only way you ever knew anything was to look on the back of the card and see what the batting average was or home runs, and you weren't afraid of math. And I said to myself, I know we're going to chat this weekend. I was going to ask you guys, were you guys good at math as kids because of baseball?
I tell you what, learning the game of baseball, it definitely taught me, like you said, the batting average, the earned run average. It definitely kept me in the mindset of that. I was your basic mathematic kind of guy when you got into college. Statistics jumped at me, but I wasn't really qualified to take those classes. As those classes just went way over my head. But not really into math, but enough math that I could get along with my life with.
How about you, Will?
Well, Marty, I got to be honest with you. You know, the only thing math class did was I went there because if I didn't go to my classes, I wasn't going to go to practice in basketball, soccer, or baseball. So that's about as much I put into my math. You know, I never was real intent on the class. I did take calculus in high school, but sorry to say, I did not fare very well in that class. Thank God I didn't need to pass it to play sports.
Well, how did you figure out your batting average? Because you had to figure that out.
Well, I let somebody else do it, Marty.
All right. It made me think of all the analytics that we have in baseball today. And the one thing, and again, watching these games, I swear, I enjoy watching these games from 20 or 30 years ago and 20 years ago. And you get a lead. You get a lead as a team, as a pitcher. It makes a difference. And with all the analytics, well, and I'll ask you this because you're in the middle of all this stuff. Do they ever tell you, boy, just get the lead and good things happen? And because I just wish that teams would play for that first run of the game. Is that an analytic that ever comes up?
Not necessarily. I mean, to your point, we don't have a lot of conversations of, you know, everybody wants to play from the lead, but more of the analytic conversations aren't based in that nature. I think it's more of the players that played the game previously understanding, like Bill as a pitcher, you know, if you get him a run or two and he goes out on the mound, you know, one of the best things for him is he doesn't have to be perfect. You know, he could walk a guy. He's not worried if he gives up one run, he's going to lose the game. And you know, that's one of the toughest things to do as a pitcher. I know when we struggle to score runs, it really puts a lot of pressure on the pitching staff. And, of course, the other thing it does playing with a lead, and I agree with you, Marty, It keeps our better pitchers in the game, right? Because you're going to your A group because you have the lead late in the game, and to the other team, you're keeping their better pitchers out of the game. So now you have you know better matchups on your side. You're not getting their best guys if they're losing most of the time. You know, sometimes obviously they do. So playing with a lead, there's so many intangibles that come to mind of freeing the player up. And also, as a manager, you can take some chances. You know, you only have so many outs and you have the lead. You could take a chance with something. Typically, people don't take chances mm-hmm. to steal or hit and run or do something when you're losing. So it can open up the game. So you're exactly right. That's the way to play.
Yeah, if Joe Torre did it, I love to watch him. Joe Torre would do anything to get that first run on the board with the Yankees. Of course, he had the Yankees, you know, which you got the run on the board, and David Cone and Wells and Messina and Clemens, and, you know, good things were going to happen. But I like it, and I know the stats say, well, if you steal a base, 0.02 chance of scoring a run is, and if he's, you know, that bunt stuff and all that. But I just tell you, You give me that first run, and I'm telling you, the game looks different. Bill, I'm sure you had to feel that way as a pitcher.
Yeah, definitely as a pitcher. I think it's a mindset because you're going 0-0 on the board until you finally score or if you open the game up. And as Ron says, you relax a little bit. You don't put your guard down, but you do have a tendency to give up a hit or a double where you're saying, okay, I gave up a hit. What do I have to do to adjust this next hitter? Where if it's 0-0 game and that double is, next thing you know, now you're going to be pitching, oh, how am I going to give up a base hit? What happens here? So the mindset of a pitcher is challenged. But when you give them 2, 3, 4 runs, oh, yeah, you can sit a little bit and you can try a little bit, different pitches, different sequences. But, you know, at the same time, if you relax too much and then you let them back in a ball game, then it's a total mindset. But I just think, as you say, Marty, I don't think they look at that anymore as much as they did in the past. The old-time managers love to do that. Sometimes you got bunts down in the earlier innings just to get a couple runs ahead. So I always wanted to pitch with the lead, but very seldom did.
Well, you know, you're probably going to have a DH here in this 82-game season. You know that's coming. We know that's coming. But are you a proponent of walking the eight-hitter to get to the pitcher early in the game?
Well, not early in the game. It depends on the scenario. If we're facing a very good club, I think it's going to be a low-scoring game. You know, they have second and third and the eighth hitter up, and there's two outs. Might do it in there to save two runs, but typically the eighth place hitter, if he's not a good hitter, and you have a matchup and there's only one guy in scoring position, I'd prefer to go ahead and pitch to him early in the game. Now, the other scenario goes, if it gets into the middle of the game and you're down by a couple of runs, two or three, and the same scenario comes up, I may walk the pitcher now because you're already losing. You can't afford to give up another run. But all things being equal, you know, you really got to wait to the situation itself comes into light. And, you know, one of the big fears over the years that come to mind with me is you got second and third and two outs and you have the eighth place hitter up and you walk him and you load the bases. Now the guy on the mound that you have, he ends up walking the pitcher. Mm-hmm. Now you got a big inning coming up, right? He walks the pitcher mm-hmm. one run and now you're at the top of the order. So I've seen it backfire. I think there's no right and wrong. I think it's very situational, knowing your guy on the mound, the command he has, and knowing who the eighth place hitter is and how good or bad the pitcher is as a hitter.
Good answer.
Yeah, what do you have? Bill, you must have been in that position. What did you do?
Well, I remember walking the eight hitter to get to the ninth, to the pitcher many a times, and it was always in that second time around in that sixth inning. Okay. Very seldom the first time around, but it was the second time around where they could pinch hit for the pitcher, force them to pinch hit for the pitcher, different mm-hmm. scenarios like that. But at the same time, you know, you always had to go after that pitcher. If you had that course where, just like Ron said, you walk that eighth hitter, you better get that ninth hitter out, especially as a pitcher. I mean, that's literally sometimes the ballgame. And sometimes the pressure, you start trying to pinch, you know, too much to the corner instead of just going after them. And and things like that happen where you do walk the pitcher, and then you're grinding a little harder. So scenario of the game, but it was usually the second time around.
What did Frank Robinson do? How did he look at it?
Oh, he screamed most of the time because if you never got the pitcher out, he would be hollering at you all the time. I mean, he thought pitchers should never even be hitting. They were the dumbest hitters. We never had any time on the field hitting. All we were supposed to do was bunt. That was his biggest thing. Learn how to bunt, bunt right, don't hit. Don't worry about hitting. I have hitters. That's Frank.
Good. I like that. All right, we'll take a break. Another good baseball discussion. This is why you guys are the best. We're going to have to put Bill on the faculty professor, you know. We're going to have to give him a title,
yeah.
Don't you think?
Yes, I think so. I think he could come in and educate a few people for us.
Yeah. We're going to have to put you on the faculty here. But we had fun last few weeks with bringing up a couple of names from the Giants in recent years, and you guys talk about them. One I want to bring up after the break is Guillermo Moda, and the other one is Eugenio Velez. And, I'm sure you got Velez stories and Moda stories as well, and they were both, you know, part of the team. And I'd love to get your feedback on those guys. So we'll take a break. More coming up right here.